Saman finally broke the silence.
"It is most odd," he said,
sounding strangely moved.
"But I have been working up my nerve to do the same thing."
"What? Destroy the transmitter?"
Leo asked.
"Yes. As a matter of fact, I dreamed a few hours ago I had done it. I felt good about it. When I woke up, I was surprised to find it intact."
"Why would you wish to destroy it?"
Arcibald asked.
"I've been observing its habits. Once every orbit, it comes into line of sight with a facility on the ground and establishes a link. Then it empties its buffer, clears its queue."
He went on to translate these Eta terms into Orth. The queue was like a stack of leaves with messages written on them, which were transmitted down to Arb whenever possible. They were sent down in the same order as they stood in the queue, like customers waiting in line at a store. "So these things in the queue are, for example, the text messages I've been writing back to my support cell on the ground?" I asked.
"How many have you written?"
he asked me. "Maybe 5.
Leo?
More like 10. Osa?"
Saman polled everyone. None had written more than a few messages.
"The number of items in the queue at this time,"
he announced,
"is over 1,400.
"What are they?"
Arcibald asked.
"Can you read them?"
"No. They are all encrypted, and no one saw fit to give me the key. Most are quite small, probably text messages, biomedical data, and associated bogons. But some of them are thousands of times larger. Since I am the only one here with knowledge of such things, I'll tell you what would be obvious to an Eta, which is that the large items are most likely recorded sound and video files."
I could think of any number of explanations for this, but Arcibald jumped directly to the most dramatic and, I had to admit, probably correct one.
"Surveillance!"
Saman made no objection.
"I have been watching the behavior of the queue during my idle moments, of which I have many. The big files behave in certain remarkable ways. For one thing, they get priority over the little ones. The system advances them to the foremost position in the queue as soon as they are created. For another, the creation of these files seems to coincide with beginnings and ends of conversations. As an example, I saw Erasmus having a private conversation with Jessery a while ago, between about 10:15 and 10:30 hours. The next time Jessery connected himself to the reticule, which was only about 15 minutes ago, a large file sprang into existence in the queue and was promptly moved to the top. Time of creation, 10:17. Last modified, 10:30.
"Is this occurring with all of our conversations?"
Leo asked. And the tone of his voice told me, as if I ever could have doubted it, that all of this was as new to him as it was to me.
"No, only some."
"I propose an experiment," Jessery said.
"Saman, does it still work?" "Oh, yes. Frajad destroyed only the transmitter. The Syndev still functions as if nothing had changed."
"Are you monitoring the queue now?"
"Of course."
Jessery disconnected and motioned for me to do the same. We formed a private connection. Jessery launched into a very old, well-worn dialogue that we'd had to memorize as FIDs, a verbal proof that the square root of 2 was an irrational number. I did my best to hold up my end of it. When we were finished, we reconnected to the reticule and waited a few seconds.
"Nothing,"
Saman said. Again we disconnected and formed a two-person link. "Do you remember back at Edhar," I began, "when we and the other incanters would sit around after dinner making everything killers out of cornstalks and shoelaces?"
"Of course," Jessery said. "Those were really good everything killers because they could assassinate filthy pendendrums like no one's business."
"That'll come in handy when we betray Arb to the pedestal," I pointed out. And so on in that vein for a couple of minutes. Then we reconnected to the reticule.
"There's a new file," Saman announced, "at the head of the queue."
"Okay," I announced. "So the pendendrums seem to be really keen on knowing if we talk about certain things, like the everything killers."
"Ah," Saman exclaimed. "A new file has just been opened, and it is growing larger the longer I keep talking."
The topic of the everything killers had not yet been broached to the group at large, and so some people had a lot of questions, which Leo fielded. Meanwhile, Jessery and I continued the experiment we had begun, breaking and reestablishing contact with the reticule a couple of dozen times over the course of the following half hour. Every time we broke away, we'd try a few more words just to see which topics triggered the automatic recording system. This was a haphazard business, but we were able to discover several more trigger words, including attack, neutron, mass murder, insane, dishonor, unconscionable, refuse, and mutiny. Every time we reconnected, we heard more ideas for possible trigger words, since the conversation was quite naturally evolving in such a way that all the words listed above, and many more, were frequently put to use. Things were becoming extremely emotional, and it was good in a way that Jessery and I were able to jack in and out of it and treat its contents as an object of theoretical study. But after a while, it reached a point where we reckoned we had better join and stay joined. Archibald had just asked a rather probing question of the Veilers. Where did their ultimate allegiance lie? Fra Osa was answering,
"To my Fras and Sures of the Ringing Veil, I have a loyalty that can never be dissolved precisely because it is no rational thing, but a bond like that of family. And I will not waste oxygen by discussing all of the nesting and overlapping loyalty groups to which I belong. This cell, the Mathic world, the Convox, the people of Arb, and the community, extending even beyond the limits of this cosmos, that unites us with the likes of Jules Verne Durand."
"C'est juste," answered the Lateran, which we'd figured out was his way of expressing approval.
"To untangle all acting loyalties and obligations is not possible in the thick of an emergence, and so one falls back on simple responses that arise from one's training."
Jules had not yet been exposed to this concept, and so Osa gave him a brief tutorial on emergenceology, using as an example the decision tree that a swordfighter must traverse in order to make the correct move during a duel. It was obvious that such a thing was far too complex to be evaluated in a rational way during a rapid exchange of cuts and thrusts, and so it must be the case that swordfighters who survived more than one or two such encounters must be doing something different. The avowed of the Ringing Veil had made the study and cultivation of that something different their sole occupation. Jules Verne Durand took the point readily.
"The analogy works as well with complex board games. We have some on La Terre, similar to yours here, in that the tree of possible moves and countermoves rapidly becomes far too vast for the brain to sort through all possibilities. Ordinators, what you'd call syntactic devices, can play the game in this style, but successful human players appear to use some fundamentally different approach that relies on seeing the whole board and detecting certain patterns and applying certain rules of thumb."
"The Teglon,"
put in Fra Jad. And he did not need to elaborate on this. We'd all seen the feat he had accomplished at Elkhazg, and it was obvious to all of us that it could not have been done by trial and error, nor by building outwards from a single starting place. He'd had to grasp the whole pattern at once.
"This is dangerous," Jessery said flatly. "It leads to saying that we may abandon the rake and behave like a bunch of enthusiasts, and everything will work out just fine because we have achieved holistic oneness with the polycosm."
"What you say is indeed a problem," said Jules. "But no one here would dare argue that it is possible to win a sword fight or solve the Teglon by behaving so self-indulgently."
"Jessery is making a straw-man argument," Archibald said. "He's raising a possible future issue. If we agree to proceed along these lines and reach a point somewhere down the line where a difficult decision needs to be made, what grounds will we have for evaluating possible decisions if we've already thrown rational analysis to the wind?"
"The ability to decide correctly at such moments must be cultivated over many years of disciplined practice and contemplation," said Fra Osa. "No one would argue that a novice could solve the Teglon simply by trusting his feelings. Fra Jad developed the ability to do it over many decades."
"Centuries," I corrected him, since I saw no benefit now in being coy about this. I heard a couple of surprised exclamations over the reticule, but no one said anything for or against the proposition. Not even Fra Jad. He did say this:
"Those who think through possible outcomes with discipline forge connections in so doing to other cosmi in which those outcomes are more than mere possibilities. Such a consciousness is measurably, quantitatively different from one that has not undertaken the same work and so, yes, is able to make correct decisions in an emergence where an untrained mind would be of little use." fine, Jessery said. But where does it get us? What are we going to do?
I think it has already gotten us somewhere, I said. When you and I rejoined this dialogue a few minutes ago, passions were inflamed and people were still trying to frame the decision in terms of allegiances and loyalties. Fra Osa has shown that any such approach will fail because we all belong to multiple groups with conflicting loyalties. This made the conversation less emotional. We've also developed an argument that it's not possible to work out all the moves in advance. But as you yourself pointed out, going on naive emotion is bound to fail.
So we must develop the same kind of decision-making ability that Fra Jad employs when he solves the Teglon, said Jessery. But that requires time and knowledge. We don't have time, and we don't have much knowledge.
We have 2 more days, said Leo.
And there is much knowledge that we can infer, said Arcibald.
Such as? Jessery asked in a skeptical tone.
That everything killers might be planted in this equipment. That our purpose might be to deliver them to the Dabinernud,
Arcibald said.
Most of this equipment isn't going to make it to the Dabinernud,
Leo pointed out.
He added, perfectly deadpan.
Those of you who review the terminal rendezvous maneuver plan will know as much.
Just us and our suits, Jessery said. That's all that will make it to the ship, if we're lucky. And they, the ones who planned this, can't predict the fate of our suits. What if we get captured by the pedestal? They might ditch our suits in space or dismantle them.
Your point is becoming clear, said Fra Osa. But it is important that you make it.
Fine. We are the weapons. The everything killers have been planted inside our bodies. We all know how it was done.
The giant pills, said Jules.
Exactly. The core temperature transponders that we swallowed before takeoff, Jessery said. Anyone passed theirs yet?
Come to think of it, no,
said Arcibald.
It seems to have taken up residence in my gut.
There you have it, said Jessery. Until those things are surgically removed, we are all living, breathing nuclear weapons.
All, said Sourve, except for Fra Jad and Jules Verne Durand. This left all of us nonplussed, so she explained.
I believe you will find their core temperature transponders rattling around loose somewhere inside their spacesuits.
I threw mine up, explained Jules.
I declined to swallow mine, said Jad.
And as the cell physician, you knew this survey because their core temp readings have been obviously wrong?
Asked Leo.
Yes, and the incorrect readings caused their suits to respond in inappropriate ways, which is why both of them required medical attention following the launch.
Why didn't you swallow your pill, Fra Jad?
Asked Arcibald.
Did you know what it was?
I judged it wiser not to,
was all that Fra Jad was willing to supply in the way of an answer.
This idea that we've all been turned into nuclear weapons is an amazing theory, I said. But I simply don't believe that Ayla would ever do such a thing.
I'm guessing she didn't know, Leo said. This must have been added onto the plan without her knowledge.
Fra Osa said,
If I were the strategist in charge, I would go to Ayla and say, Please assemble the team you deem most capable of getting aboard the Dabinernud. And her answer would come back, I will do it by making friends with those among the geometers who are opposed to the pedestal. They'll take our people in and offer them assistance.
That is monstrous, I said.
Monstrous. Probably another trigger word, Jessery mused. I wanted to slug him, but he was making an excellent point.
2 days later, we stripped off our white coveralls, then drew down the retractable shields to conceal the lights and displays on our suit fronts. We were all matte black now. Like mountaineers, we roped ourselves together with a braided line that doubled as safety rope and communications wire. Jad, Jessery, and I had spent much of the last shift working with the sextant and making calculations. These culminated with Fra Jad hanging off the underside of the nuke with a knife in one hand, sighting down the length of the tether as if it were a gun barrel, watching the constellations wheel behind it. At the instant when a particular star came into alignment with the tether, he slashed through it with a knife. The tether and the counterweight at its end flew off into space, and so did we, picking up a final momentum adjustment that would, we hoped, sync our orbit with that of the Dabinernud. Half an hour later, we all braced our feet against the underside of the mirror, and at a signal from Leo, pushed it away, or jumped off, depending on your frame of reference. The mirror glided out of the way to give us our first direct look at the Dabinernud. It was so close to us now that we could hardly see anything, just a single triangular facet of the icosahedron, filling most of our visual field. Essentially, all of the geometer's surveillance and remote sensing systems had been designed to look at things that were thousands of miles away. As Jessery and the others had learned when they had brought the Warden of Heaven here, the Dabinernud did have short-range radars for illuminating things that were nearby, but there was no reason to keep them switched on unless visitors were expected. And we had not emerged from behind the cold black mirror until we had approached too close even for those radars to work very well. This was partly luck. If our trajectory had been a little less precise, we'd have been forced to ditch the mirror farther out, and thereby exposed ourselves to the scrutiny of those systems. But Fra Jad had wielded his knife at just the right instant. If he did nothing else for the rest of the mission, he would still have earned his place. In order to see us, they'd have to literally see us. Someone would have to look out a window, or more likely at a spelecaptor feed, and just happened to notice 11 matte black humanoids gliding in against the background of space. Its surface was like a shingle beach, flat, assembled from countless pieces of asteroids that had been scavenged from four different cosmi. Light glinted among the stones, the wire mesh that held them together. It seemed as though we were going to collide with a shock piston, which cut straight across our path like a horizon. But we cleared it by a few yards and found ourselves gliding along above a new face of the icosahedron, currently in shadow. Each of us was armed with a spring-loaded gun, and so at a signal from Leo, 11 grappling hooks shot out toward the rubble shield, trailing lines behind them. I'd estimate that half of them snagged in the mesh holding the rocks together. One by one, the grapnel lines went taut and began to pull back on those who had fired them. This caused the ropes that joined us to go tight in a complex and unpredictable train of events, and so there were a few moments of bashing into one another and gratuitous entanglement as the whole cell came to the end of this improvised web of tethers. Our momentum caused us to swing forward and down toward the rubble, a scary development that was somewhat mitigated by the four Veilers who had been issued cold gas thrusters that they held out before them like pistols and fired in the direction we didn't want to go. This led to further collisions and entanglements that bordered on the ridiculous, but did have the net effect of slowing us down some. As we got closer, we tried to get legs and or arms out in front of ourselves to serve as shock absorbers. I was able to plant my right foot on a boulder. The impact torqued me around. I spun and punched another 4.5-billion-year-old rock with the stumpy end of my suit arm, just in time to avoid planting my face on it. Then various ropes jerked on me from multiple vectors and dragged me along for a short ways. But soon everyone stopped bouncing and dragging and managed to grip the wire mesh with their fingers, giving Cell 317 a secure purchase on the Dabinernud.
Requiem. The Aught celebrated to mark the death of an avout. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
The darkness was nearly perfect. Arb was on the other side of the ship and shed no light here. A new moon, though, was swinging up through the cluttered horizon of the nearest shock piston, strewing faint light by which we cut ourselves apart and sorted ourselves out. Our magnetic boot soles stuck faintly to the icosahedron, a rubble of nickel and iron. Moving like a man with gum on the soles of his shoes, Saman made the rounds and checked our connections to the rope wire.
"This facet will remain in darkness for another 20 minutes, Jessery informed us, "after which we have to move to that one."
I supposed he was pointing at one of the three shock pistons that made up our local horizon, but I couldn't see him. As the Dabinernud revolved around Arb, the terminator, the dividing line between the sunlit and shaded halves of the icosahedron, crept around it. On any given facet, sunrise or sunset would be explosively sudden. We'd better not get caught in the open when it happened, because the citadel-like complexes that loomed over the 12 vertices had clear views over the surrounding facets.
"According to my equipment," announced Fra Gratho, "we did not get illuminated by any short-range radar." "They simply don't have it turned on," said Leo. "But sooner or later, they'll probably notice the Monyafix that Fra Jad cut loose, or the coal black mirror, and then they'll go to a higher state of alert. So, which way to the world burner?"
"Follow me,"
said Fra Osa, and started walking. If walking was the right word for such a clumsy style of locomotion. I'd like to say we moved as drunks, but it would be an insult to every sloshed Fra who had staggered back to his cell in the dark. Much of our 20 minutes of darkness was burned moving the first couple of 100 feet. After that, though, we learned, if not what to do, then at least what not to do, and reached the nearest horizon with a few minutes' darkness to spare. The shock piston was like a pipeline half buried in the rubble, but reinforced with fin-like trusses to prevent it from buckling like a straw when it was under load. At its ends, about a mile away in either direction, it swelled like the end of a bone and developed into a heavy steel knuckle. 5 such knuckles, coming together from different directions, formed the base of each vertex. Each vertex was different, but in general, they had been cobbled together from a mess of domes, cylinders, gridwork, and antennae. Extravagant bouquets of silver parabolic horns flourished from their tops, waiting for their turn to gaze into our sun and steal some of our light. The triangular rubble field across which we'd been walking didn't butt up hard against the shock piston, because there had to be some give in the system. A shock absorber that had been, in effect, welded to a stiff triangular plate all along its length would not be able to function. Instead, the facet stopped 10 feet short of the trusswork that enshrouded the shock and was sewn to it by a system of cables that zigzagged over pulleys. At a glance, it looked awfully complicated and made me think of sailboats, not starships. But since the Ernudans had been building such things for 1,000 years, I guessed they had come up with a way to make it work. Light shone up from the chasm below. As we neared it, we slowed, bent forward, and gazed into the interior of the icosahedron, a volume of some 23 cubic miles, softly illuminated by sunlight, slitting in through other such gaps and scattering from the icosahedron's inner walls and the 16 orbs. It was all as we'd seen it rendered on the model, but of course to see it in person was altogether different. The view was dominated by the nearest of the orbs, swinging by as fast as the second hand on a clock, helpfully painted with a huge numeral in the Ernudan writing system. I had learned enough of this to translate it as number 5. Orb 5 housed high-ranking Troans. All of my instincts told me to fear the jump across the gap, because if I fell in, I would drop for some vast distance before getting splattered on a rotating orb. But of course, there was no gravity here, no down, nothing to fall into. Osa went first, launching himself across the gap and getting himself established on the struts that lent strength to the shock piston. Vey was the last on the line. Once we'd all made it over, we hand-over-handed our way across the shock out of concern that the snapping of our magnetic boots against its steel would create an obvious acoustical signature. There was a dizzy moment when our settled conception of up and down was challenged by the next facet swinging into view, defining a new level and a new horizon. Then we got used to it and floated across another gap, using the same procedure as before. This was perhaps an overly cautious way to travel 10 feet through space, but if we all did it at once and jumped too hard, we might drift away. Sun was striking the struts we had just passed over as we planted our feet on the next facet of the icosahedron, where we could be assured of a few hours' darkness. This was more time than we needed, or to speak truthfully, it was more than we had, since we only had an hour's oxygen remaining and the tender was gone. 2 miles away, directly across the facet, was a hydrogen bomb the size of a 6-story office building. It was essentially egg-shaped, but like a beetle caught in spider's webbing, its form was blurred by a fantastic tangle of strutwork and plumbing connecting it to the vertex citadel. Indeed, that whole vertex appeared to have no practical use other than to serve as a support base for the world burner. Even if it hadn't been so enormous, it would have been a difficult thing to miss, because it was all lit up. lit up for the benefit of 100 people in spacesuits clambering around on it.
Do you think they're getting ready to launch it?
Archibald asked.
I don't think they're giving it a new paint job, Jessery said.
Very well,
Leo said. I didn't know who he was speaking to or what he was giving his assent to. A click on the line suggested that someone had just jacked out. Our view of the World Burner complex was interrupted now by four black spacesuited figures who had broken away from the rest of us. In the dark, with the suits in stealth mode, we could not tell one another apart, but something in the way that these four moved convinced me that they were the Ringing Veil contingent. They walked abreast, with one, presumably Fra Osa, slightly ahead of the others. They were spreading a little farther apart with each step.
Leo, what is happening?
I asked.
An emergence,
he reasoned. When the four Veilers were spaced about 20 feet apart, Fra Osa deployed his Skellahans and, like a step rider in a shootout, drew a pair of pistol-like objects, the cold gas thrusters, from holsters bracketed to the hips of his suit. The other three did likewise. Then, to all appearances, Fra Osa fell on his face. He planted his feet next to each other and let his momentum carry his body forward, peeling his magnetic soles loose from the rubble. As soon as he lost that connection to the icosahedron, his feet swung up and his whole body pivoted in space until he was prone. And in the same moment, he began to glide headfirst toward the World Burner. He was holding both arms down to his sides, pointing the cold gas guns toward his feet, using them to thrust himself across the rubble plain, like a low-flying superhero. They, Esma, and Gratho were all doing likewise. In their wake, we could see a roiling in the light, like heat waves, as the plumes of clear gas dissolved into space. At first, their movement was achingly gradual, but they rapidly picked up speed, sometimes porpoising up, then correcting it with a calm inflection of the wrist, spreading out as they vectored themselves toward different parts of the World Burner complex, sliding with a kind of wicked, silent beauty over the glossy purple-blue rubble plain. We were able to see them only in silhouette against the lights of the sprawling complex, and that only for the first few moments of their flight. Then they were as invisible to us as they were to the space-suited geometers swarming over the bomb. Leo announced,
"We have perhaps only a few minutes to get inside and find something to breathe before every door in the Dabin Urnut is locked against us."
"What about the Veilers?"
Archibald said.
"I think it would be wisest to assume that they and everyone working on the World Burner are as good as dead,"
Leo said, after a moment's thought.
"They are attacking now?" I asked.
"They are boarding it now,"
Leo said. Or, technically speaking, reminded me, for we had discussed this eventuality. What if, when we come in sight of the World Burner, we see evidence that the geometers are just about to launch it? Ah, well, of course that would change everything. We'd have to fork to a completely different branch of the plan. Not a moment to spare. I knew we'd gone over it. But I had filed it in my head under the category of things very unlikely to happen, hence safely forgotten. Leo, however, had not forgotten.
"If the Veilers can manage to get aboard the World Burner covertly, they'll hide and take no further action until just before their air supply runs out. That's to give the rest of us time to find a way in. But if the World Burner launches, or if someone sees them and raises the alarm, well, bad things will happen,"
Jessery snapped.
"So we might or might not have a little time," I said.
"Which means we should act as if we have none at all,"
Leo returned.
"Jules?"
For the Lateran had been silent for a long time.
"You still with us?"
"Pardon me," Jules returned. "I am amazed, thinking of the havoc that our friends of the Ringing Veil are about to unleash. It is an inconceivable nightmare for the pedestal, the worst embarrassment they will have suffered in 1,000 years. My loyalties are torn several ways, you know."
"No matter how much conflict is in your soul," I said,
"you can't possibly object to the destruction of the World Burner, can you?"
"No,"
said Jules softly but distinctly.
"In that, my feelings are unalloyed. What a shame if some of those working on it are slain, but to work on such a horrible device."
He did not finish the sentence. but I knew that inside his spacesuit, he was shrugging. So mainly you just don't want to introduce everything killers to the Dabinernud, I said.
That is certainly correct,
Leo broke in.
I never thought I'd hear myself saying this, but take us to your leader.
I beg your pardon?
Point us to the Ernudans. Then your work is done. You can go home and get a decent meal. Which is more than we can say for ourselves,
Arcibald pointed out.
Yes, Jules said. The irony. No food for you. Not here.
So then,
Leo said,
what is your decision?
All of us shared his impatience, if for no other reason than that we were running out of air. I'd like to report that I was still thinking coolly, applying the rake to everything that was clattering through my mind. But in truth, I was stunned and bewildered and, if this made sense, hurt by the sudden departure of Osa, Vey, Esma, and Gratho. I had known, of course, that there were various contingency plans, had never fooled myself that I could know all of them, but I'd been telling myself all along that the Veilers would always be with us. When I'd first seen them on the coach at Tredegar, I'd been horrified by the idea that I was about to be sent off on the kind of mission where such persons might be needed. But over the days since, I'd grown used to, and proud of, being on just such a mission. Now here we were, at its most critical moment, and the Veilers were suddenly gone, without explanation, without even a goodbye and good luck. The logic of the decision they had made was unassailable. What could be more important than disabling the world burner? But where did it leave the rest of us? Is it possible, I heard myself saying, that we are a spent delivery mechanism, like those boosters that threw us into space to be dumped into the sea?
That's totally plausible,
Jessery said, without hesitation.
We did our lessons well and played some clever tricks to get the four Veilers here. That job is done. Now, here we are, no food, no oxygen, no communications, and no way home.
You overestimate the importance of the world burner,
Jad announced.
It is a bluff. Its existence forces our military to act in ways it would not otherwise. Its destruction gives our back a measure of freedom. But what use the secular power will make of that freedom is yet to be known, and our actions may yet be of some importance. We go on.
Jules,
Leo said.
How about it?
It is tempting to drop through this opening before us, no?
Jules said. For we had instinctively turned our backs on the world burner, as if this would protect us from whatever was about to erupt there. Once more we were gazing down into the gap, watching orbs 6 and 7 rotate past, glimpsing the core and the cleft between them.
But then we are in the light, where we may be seen, and the orb stack rotates with too much velocity for us ever to catch it. No, we must go in via the core, but to enter the core we must first go in at a vertex.
He toddled around until he was gazing at the vertex that, as we faced the shock piston, was to our left.
That is the observatory. You've studied the pictures.
He toddled right.
That one is a military command post.
Does the observatory have airlocks?
Arcibald asked. For all of us were now looking leftward. No one felt up to invading a military command post, not after we had lost our Veilers.
Oh, yes, you are looking at one, said Jules, and began walking toward it.
We fell in step.
I am?
The dome that houses the telescope is itself a great airlock,
Jules explained.
Makes sense,
Jessery said.
To work on the telescope, they'd want to flood the dome with air. Then, when they were ready to make observations, they'd evacuate it and expose it to space.
Which is where I normally would have become irritated with Jessery for lecturing the rest of us. But it went by me. I was fascinated, dumbfounded, by an idea I had not dared to think of for a week. Taking my suit off. Being able to touch my face. Arcibald was on the same track.
The way I smell will probably seem funny when I reminisce about it years hence. Yes,
Leo said.
If odors can travel between cosmi, everything downwick of us is about to die.
Thanks for the preview, Jessery said. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, I suggested. Saman asked,
is anyone going to be on duty in this observatory?
Perhaps not physically there, Joel said. The telescopes are controlled remotely on our version of the reticulum. But the big one will be in use, certainly, making a survey of your lovely cosmos, which is all new to us.
The vertex was looming mountainously as we carried on this conversation. Old instincts warned me that we had an exhausting climb ahead of us, but of course it was no climb at all because we were weightless. Without having to discuss it, we made for the highest and largest of the domes, which, as Jules had promised, was open. It was a spherical shell, split into two hemispheres, which had spread apart on tracks to expose a multi-segmented mirror with a diameter of some 30 feet. We all clambered through the gap between the hemispheres, which was wide enough to throw a 3-bedroom house through, and hand over handed ourselves down to the level of the trusses and gimbals that supported the mirror, all following, I think, a sort of instinct to get indoors, under cover, away from the terrible exposure we had been living with for so long. Jules pointed out a hatch by which we could gain entry to the pressurized regions of the vertex once the dome had been closed and filled with air. There was even a nice big red panic button that we could slam to emergency pressurize the dome, but he advised us not to use it, because this would trigger alarms all over the Dabinernod. Instead, he pulled himself up on the struts that held the telescope's objective suspended at the mirror's focal point. He peeled the reflective blanket off of his chest and stuffed it in there, then clambered down to rejoin us. Meanwhile, the rest of us tried to stay calm and control our breathing. Archibald, who used more oxygen than anyone else, was down to 10 minutes. Saman had 25. The two of them swapped oxygen tanks. I had 18. Leo suggested we all try to eat as much as possible. If we were separated from our suits, we'd have no food left, except for a few energy bars that we could carry with us. So I sucked more gruel from the nozzle and made a prolonged and labored effort not to throw it right back up into the scupper.
"Hello,"
called Jules, more as an exclamation than a greeting. It took us a moment to understand that he was responding to a face that had appeared in the porthole of the hatch, some cosmographer come to see why the big scope had gone dark. Based on Jules' lessons, I guessed, from the hue of her eyes and the shape of her nostrils, that she was Phothosian. And though it would take some time to learn Phothosian facial expressions, I reckoned I had now seen two of them, befuddlement followed by shock, as a matte black spacesuit of unfamiliar design loomed in her window. Jules grabbed handles flanking the hatch and pressed his faceplate against the glass. Then we all had to turn down the volume in our phones as he began to holler in what I assumed was Phothosian. The woman inside got the idea and pressed her ear against the window. Sound would not travel through the vacuum of space, but by shouting loud enough, Jules could excite vibrations in his face mask that would be transmitted by direct contact into the glass of the porthole and thence into the cosmographer's ear. He repeated himself. He somehow managed to sound more cheerful than desperate. His tone seemed to say it was all in good sport. The woman's lips moved as she shouted back. The dome illuminated. I reckoned she had hit the light switch to get a better look at what was going on, but on second thought, this light was pouring in through the gap between the hemispheres. The sun must have risen? We'd been warned of explosive sunrises, but this seemed explosive in more ways than one. The light flared, faded, and flared brighter. It burbled and boiled. A slight concussion passed through the frame of the icosahedron. Leo sprang up so smartly that he almost committed the fatal mistake of flying straight up out of the dome and off into space. But he caught himself short by gripping the comm wire that linked him to the rest of us, and swung around above the telescope mirror until he finally contrived to stop himself short on the edge of a dome half. The light, which was slowly dying, reflected in his face mask.
"The world burner," he said. "I think they must have blown the propellant tanks."
Then, with a sudden exclamation, he pushed off and glided back down to what I was thinking of as the floor of the dome. For the giant hemispheres had gone into movement, and the slit between them was narrowing decisively. The lights really did come on now. The slit disappeared with a clunk, felt not heard. For better or worse, we were trapped here now. I kept eyeing the big red emergency button. I had 8 minutes. A readout on my display began to change. Outside air pressure, which had been a red zero ever since I'd been launched into the vacuum of space, was climbing up toward the yellow zone. Jules had noticed the same thing. He went over to a grated vent near the hatch and reached for it. His arm was batted aside by inrushing air.
"Thank Cardus,"
Archibald said.
"I don't care what cosmos this air came from. I just want to breathe it." "While we are waiting, reacquaint yourselves with the doffing procedure," Leo told us, "and show yourselves."
He pulled up the screen that had been hiding his readouts. The rest of us did likewise. For the first time in a couple of hours, we were able to see one another's faces on the Speely screens and to check one another's readouts. I could not see everyone in the group, because we were distributed around a cluttered and complex space beneath the mirror supports. But I could see Jessery, who had 2 minutes. I had 5. I swapped canisters with him. It was taking a long time to pressurize the dome. A few minutes later, the external pressure readout finally changed from yellow to green. Good enough to breathe. Just as my oxygen supply indicator was going from red, extreme danger, to black, you are dead. With my last lungful of ARB air, I spoke the command that opened my suit to the surrounding atmosphere. My ears popped. My nose stung and registered a funny smell. That of something, anything, other than my own body. Leo, who'd been keeping a sharp eye on my readouts, I had less oxygen than anyone else that I could see, stepped behind me and hauled the back of my suit open. I withdrew my arms, got a grip on the rim of the HTU, and pulled myself stark naked out of the accursed thing. I breathed alien air. My comrades watched me with no small interest. The only other Arbran to have breathed this stuff had been the Warden of Heaven, who apparently hadn't lasted more than a few minutes. My hands flew to my face. I kneaded it, scratched my nose, rubbed a week's sleep from my eyes, ran my fingers up into my hair. Could have thought of more edifying things to do, but it was a biological imperative. Leo groped on his front, found a switch, flicked it.
"Can you hear me?"
"Yeah, I can hear you." The others took to groping for their switches.
"Not that it makes a difference, since we all have to get out, but what is it like, my fraw?"
"My heart is pounding like crazy," I said, and paused, since to say that much had worn me out. "I thought I was just excited, but maybe this air doesn't work for us." I was speaking in bursts between gasps for air. My body was telling me to breathe faster. I could see why the Warden of Heaven blew an aneurysm.
"Raz?"
"Breathe. Breathe."
"Yeah?"
"Breathe. Breathe. Breathe."
"Get me out of this thing,"
Leo insisted. Jessery grabbed Leo, spun him around, yanked his door open. Leo got out of his suit as if it were on fire. He floated over with a mad look on his face. All my habits from home told me to get out of Leo's way when he approached in that mood, but I simply didn't have the strength. His arms, which had subjected me to so much rough treatment over the years, came around me in a bear hug. He pressed his ear against my chest. His scalp was like thistles. I felt his ribcage begin heaving. Jessery and Archibald and Jules were swimming free of their suits. Jules went straight to the hatch, threw a lever, and shoved it open. Everything faded. Not to darkness, but to a washed-out yellow-gray, as if too much light were shining through it. Fra Jad and I were floating in a white corridor. I was naked. He was dressed in one of the gray coveralls we had brought up in our kit. Evidence suggested he had been rummaging in a steel locker set into the wall. 2 clumps of silvery fabric were floating near him. He teased one open. It turned out to have arms and legs. From time to time, he glanced my way. When he noticed me looking at him, he tossed me a gray packet in a poly bag, another folded-up coverall.
"Put this on," he said. "Then over it, the silver garment."
"Are we going to put out a fire?"
"In a manner of speaking."
The effort of tearing open the poly wrapper set my heart pounding. Pulling on the coverall plunged me deep into oxygen debt. Once I had recovered enough to get a few words out, I asked,
"Where are the others?"
"There is a narrative, not terribly dissimilar to the one you and I are perceiving, in which they went to explore the ship.
Their plan is to surrender peacefully whenever someone notices them.
Is there any particular reason they left us behind?
Emergence from the suit after so long. Finding oneself in a confined space after having grown accustomed to the unobstructed vastness. Breathing an atmosphere from a different cosmos. Effects of long-term weightlessness. General stress and excitement. All of these induce a syndrome that lasts for a few minutes, a kind of going into shock that can produce confusion or even loss of consciousness. Soon it passes if one is healthy. I infer that it was too much for the Warden of Heaven.
So, I tried, after we doffed the suits, we were all confused or unconscious for a few minutes. Meaning, in your system of thought, we lost our grip on the narrative, stopped tracking it. Whatever faculty of consciousness enables it continuously to do the fly-bat-worm trick, it shut down for a while there.
Yes. And the others regained consciousness in a world track in which you and I are dead.
Dead.
That is what I told you.
So that's why they left us behind, I said. They didn't leave us behind because, in their world track, we never even made it here.
Yes. Put this on.
He handed me a full-face respirator.
What of the Phothosian astronomer? Won't she summon the authorities or something?
She went with Jules. He is talking to her. He has a gift for that kind of thing.
So Leo, Arcibald, Jesri, and Saman are just wandering around the ship openly, looking for someone to surrender to?
Such a world track exists.
It's pretty bizarre.
Not at all. Such occurrences are common in the confusion of war.
Well, how about this world track? Where are the four of them doing in the narrative that you and I are in?
I'm in several, Frajad said. A state of affairs that is not easy to sustain. Your questions hardly make it easier. So here is a simple answer. The others are all dead.
I don't wish to abide in a world track where my friends are all dead, I said. Take me back to the other one.
There is no taking and there is no back, Jad said. Only going and forward.
I don't want to be in a narrative where my friends are dead, I insisted.
Then you have two choices. Put yourself out the airlock or follow me.
And Frajad pulled the respirator over his face, terminating our conversation. He handed me a fire extinguisher and took one for himself. Then he shoved off down the corridor. Now my mind did something absurd. Namely, attended to the nuts and bolts of the ship instead of the things that were truly important. It was as though some barb-like part of me had stepped to the fore, elbowed my soul out of the way and directed all of my energies and faculties toward those things that Barb would find interesting, such as door-latching mechanisms. Subsystems responsible for irrelevancies such as grieving for my friends, fearing death, being confused about the world tracks, and wanting to strangle Frajad, were starved of resources. There were many doors, all closed but not locked. This was, according to Jules, the usual state of affairs here. These outer reaches of the ship were divided into separate, independently pressurized compartments, so that a meteor strike in one wouldn't beggar its neighbors. Consequently, one spent an inordinate amount of time opening and closing doors. These were domed round hatches about 3 feet in diameter with heavy bank vault-like latching mechanisms. One opened them by grabbing two symmetrical handles and pulling them opposite ways, which was handy in zero gravity where planting one's feet and using one's body weight were not supported by theoretical law. The effort always left me panting for breath in Frajad's wake. One of the questions I had meant to annoy him with had been, "Why me? Can't you do whatever it is you are doing alone, so that I can be in a narrative where my friends are alive?" And maybe this was the answer. I'd been picked out for the same reason that the hierarchs at Edhar had made me part of the bell-ringing team. I was a lummox. I could open heavy doors. It seemed preferable to doing nothing, so I floated ahead of Frajad and applied myself to it. Every time I hauled one open, I expected to find myself staring down the muzzle of an Ernudan Space Marine's weapon. But there simply weren't that many people here in the observatory. and when we did finally encounter someone in a corridor, she gasped and got out of our way. The firefighter disguise was so simple, so obvious, I'd assumed it could never work. But it had worked perfectly on the first person we had met, which probably meant it would work as well on the next 100. That corridor led to a spherical chamber that apparently served as the foyer for the whole vertex. We had to pass through it anyway to get out of this vertex and reach other parts of the Dabin Urnud. As we discovered by trial and error, one of its exits communicated with a very long tubular shaft. "The tendon," I announced, when I discovered it. Fra Jad nodded and launched himself down it. The stupendous icosahedron and its imposing vertex citadels had accounted for almost all of my impressions of the ship until now. Their size and their strangeness made it easy to forget that essentially all of the Dabin Urnud's complexity and population lay elsewhere, in the spinning orb stack. Until now, Fra Jad and I had been like a couple of barbarians kicking down doors in an abandoned guardhouse on the frontier of an empire. Here, though, we had set out on the road that would take us to the capital. There were a dozen tendons. Six radiated from each of the mighty bearings at the ends of the orb stack. The orb stack was like a monkey using its arms and legs to brace itself in the middle of a packing crate. Sometimes an arm had to push, sometimes it had to pull. It flexed to absorb shocks. It was alive. A bundle of bones that gave strength, muscles that reacted, vessels that transported materials, nerves that communicated, and skin that protected all of the rest. The tendons had to perform all of the same functions and so shared much of that complexity. All that Fra Jad and I could see of this tendon was the inner surface of a 10-foot diameter shaft. But we knew from talking to Jules that the tendon as a whole was more than 100 feet wide and crammed with structure and detail hidden from our view, but richly hinted at by a bewilderingly various series of hatches, valve wheels, wiring panels, display screens, control panels, and signs that shimmered by us as we flew along. Since it was impossible for novices such as we to get aimed perfectly down the center, we strayed from side to side as we went along. Whenever we came in slapping range of a likely-looking handhold, we'd give it a bit of abuse and earn some speed, then take a lot of deep breaths while coasting to the next. About halfway along, we encountered a group of 4 geometers who, when they saw us coming, grabbed handholds and crouched against the wall to make way. As we flew by, they shouted what I assumed were questions, which we had little choice but to ignore. The hatch at the end opened onto a domed chamber about 100 feet across, by far the largest open volume we had yet seen. I knew it had to be the forward-bearing chamber. This was confirmed by the fact that it had a navel in its floor, perhaps 20 feet across, and everything that we could see on the other side of it was rotating. We had reached the forward end of the core. Surrounding, but invisible to us, was the immense bearing that connected the spinning orb stack to the non-spinning complex of icosahedron and tendons that guarded it. It was a mess. 6 tendon shafts were plumbed into this thing via huge portals shot into its domed ceiling. Fra Jad and I had just emerged from one of them. The adjacent one was the focus of a huge amount of activity and attention. It looked like one of those pits in great cities where stocks are traded. This, of course, was the tendon that led to the World Burner Complex, or what was left of it now that the Veilers had got to it. People were flying into or issuing from it at a rate of about 2 per second. It was like watching the entrance of a hornet's nest in high summer. Most of those going into it were carrying weapons or tools. Some of those coming out were injured. The ingoing and outgoing streams collided in the bearing chamber, and others tried to sort things out, to tell people where to go, what to do, without much result that I could discern, save that they ended up arguing with each other. I was just as happy I couldn't understand what they were saying. The chaos made it almost too easy for me and Fra Jad to move around without attracting notice. In fact, my only problem was distinguishing the Thousander from other men in firefighting gear. But after a brief moment of anxiety when I feared I'd lost him, I spied a likely-looking firefighter gazing in my direction and pointing toward what I had begun to think of as the floor of the chamber, the flat surface with the big hole in the middle of it. The hole was getting smaller. As Jules had explained, wherever the Dabin Urnud's architects had needed to forge a connection between major parts of the core, they had used a ball valve, which was just a sphere with a fat hole drilled through the middle, held captive in a spherical cavity, bridging the two spaces in question. The sphere couldn't go anywhere, but it was free to rotate. Depending on how the hole in its middle was aligned, it could allow free passage or form an impregnable barrier. Such a valve was set into the floor of this chamber. It was so huge that at first I hadn't seen it for what it was. But now that it had gone into motion, its nature and its function were perfectly obvious. It moved ponderously, but by the time Fra Jad managed to draw my attention to it, the thing was already about half closed, like an eyeball slowly drifting into sleep. Fra Jad planted his feet against a soldier's backside and shoved off, driving the soldier toward the ceiling and him down toward the ball valve. I was already near a sort of ladder or catwalk, which I pushed off against to propel myself after him. When we got to the ball valve, the aperture had narrowed to perhaps 3 feet at its widest. Plenty of room to squeeze through. But we had used up all our momentum just getting there, and our aim had been miserable. After some feverish banging around, we drifted through the aperture and found ourselves hovering in the bore of the sphere, watching the eye at its other end get smaller. There were no handholds that we could use to move ourselves along. If we didn't reach the other end by the time it closed, we'd be imprisoned until the next time they opened the valve. I was too out of breath to do much anyway. I aimed my fire extinguisher back the way we had come and pulled the trigger. The recoil forced it back against me. I took the force with my arms and felt myself tumbling backwards. But I was moving. I slammed into the socket wall at the end, scrabbled for a handhold on the rim of the hole, and pulled myself through. A second later, Fra Jad squirted through on a snowy plume of fire retardant. I grabbed his ankle, which slowed him down quite a bit. We found ourselves adrift and slowly tumbling at the forward extremity of the 2-mile-long, 100-foot-diameter shaft that ran the length of the orb stack. We had made it to the core. And if any of those we had left behind in the bearing chamber had found our behavior suspicious, they had not been adroit enough to follow us through the ball valve. Smaller hatches, airlocks made for one person at a time, were planted around it so that people could pass between core and bearing chamber even when the ball valve was closed. I kept a nervous eye on those, half expecting a space cop to fly out and accost us, but then reasoned that it simply wasn't going to happen. Jules' words of a few minutes ago came back to me. What the Veilers had done, what we had done, had been the worst military embarrassment these people had suffered in 1,000 years. The bomb was still on fire, the disaster only getting started. The Veilers might still be alive and fighting, so they weren't going to make a big deal about a couple of firefighters acting weird. Our panicky flight through the valve had imbued us with momentum that carried us outward toward the wall of the core, which was rotating about as fast as the second hand on a clock. This meant that when we drifted into the wall, it was moving past us at a brisk walking pace. This part of the core wall was covered with a grid with convenient hand-sized holes between the bars, so we did what came naturally and grabbed it. The effect was gentle but inexorable acceleration that made our feet spin out to find purchase on the grid. We were now rotating along with everything else. Here our body weight was less than that of a newborn infant, but it was the most gravity we had known for a long time, and took a little getting used to. We clung to it for a couple of minutes, gasping for air, trying not to black out. Then Fra Jad, never one to discuss his plans and intentions with his traveling companions, pushed off and glided along the core wall, headed for the first of the 4 great nexi that were spaced evenly along its length. Travel was easier in micro than in zero gravity because we slowly fell to the core wall, where we could always push off and get another dose of momentum. Available was a sort of rapid transit system, consisting of a moving conveyor belt cum ladder that glided up one side of the core and down the other. Most of the people we could see, perhaps 100, heavily skewed toward soldiers and firefighters, were using it. The rungs were elastic, so that when you grabbed one, it didn't simply jerk your arm from its socket. Tired as I was tempted to have a go, but didn't want to make a spectacle of myself. Fra Jad showed no interest. We moved more slowly than those who were using it, which worked to our advantage. Some of them shouted questions at us as they glided by, but none was inquisitive enough to jump off and pursue the conversation. In a few minutes, we came to the station in the core where the forwardmost orbs, 1, 5, 9, and 13, were connected. Each of these stood at the head of a stack of four. So orbs 1 through 4 were for Newtons, 5 through 8 were Troan, 9 through 12 were Lateran, and the rest, Phothosian. By convention, the lowest number orb in each stack, the ones that connected here at the heads of the stacks, were for the highest-ranking members of their respective races. So this nexus was the most convenient place for the Geometer's VIPs to meet. From where we were, it didn't look like much, just four cavernous holes in the wall, the termini of perpendicular shafts leading out to the orbs. According to Jules, though, if we were to look at it from the outside, we would see that this part of the core was wrapped in a donut of offices, meeting chambers, and ring corridors where the command had its offices. Several hatches in the core wall hinted at this, but conflict between Pedestal and Fulcrum had led to a division of the command torus into parts of unequal size. Hatches had been locked, partitions welded into place, guards posted, cables severed. None of which concerned us very much, since the space we were in served only as a service corridor or elevator shaft, rarely visited or thought about by the command. Of much greater interest to us were the four huge orifices in the core wall. As we drifted into the nexus, we were able to gaze into these and see tubular shafts, each about 20 feet in diameter, each leading down about a quarter of a mile. At the bottom of each was another huge ball valve, currently closed. Beyond each such valve was an inhabited orb a mile wide. It wasn't difficult to identify the shaft leading to Orb 1. A large numeral was painted on the core wall next to it. The numeral was Ernewton, but any sentient being from any cosmos could recognize it as the glyph that represented Unity, One, a single copy of something. I, however, did not have time to linger and contemplate its profound meaning, as Fra Jad had already located a ladder bracketed to the wall of the shaft and begun to descend it. I followed him. Gravity slowly came on as we went. It's hard to describe how terrible this made me feel. The only thing that kept me from passing out was fear I'd let go of the rungs and fall down on top of Fra Jad. During the worst spell, a voice drilled into my awareness and made my skull buzz. Fra Jad had begun to sing some thousander chant, like the one that had kept me awake at the Bayesian Monastery on the night we had been evoked. It gave my consciousness something to hold on to, like the steel ladder rung that I was gripping with my hand, my only hard, tangible link to the giant complex spinning around me. And in the same way that the rung kept me from falling, the sound of Jad's voice in my skull kept my mind from floating away to wherever it had gone when I had passed out in the observatory and awoken on the wrong world track. I kept descending. I was crouching atop a giant steel navel with my head between my knees, trying not to pass out. Fra Jad was punching numbers into a keypad mounted to the wall. The sphere began to rotate beneath me.
"How did you know the code?" I asked.
"I selected a number at random," he said.
I'd heard only four beeps from the keypad. Only a four-digit number. Only 10,000 possible combinations. So if there were 10,000 Jads in 10,000 branches of the world track, and if I were lucky enough to be with the right one... Sunlight was shining through the bore of the valve. I flattened myself on it and gazed down on open water, vegetation, and buildings from an altitude of half a mile. This time, the bore of the valve had ladder rungs on it. We climbed down them even as the valve was snapping to its final position and exited onto a ring-shaped catwalk hung from the ceiling of the orb surrounding the aperture. The oculus at the top of a vast spherical dome. A little sky above a little world. A stairway led up to it. Men with weapons were running up the stairway, intent on saying hello to us. Fra Jad, seeing this, pulled off his respirator. No point in maintaining the disguise now. I did likewise. Two soldiers peering down shotgun barrels reached the catwalk. One of them moved aggressively toward Fra Jad. I stepped forward, instinctively, holding up my hands. My attention was drawn to a small silver object in Fra Jad's hand. Like a G-jaw, of all things. The other soldier pivoted toward me and swung the butt of his weapon around, catching me in the jaw. I toppled backward over the rail and felt my old friend, Zero Gravity, taking me back into its embrace as I went into freefall down the middle of the orb. Something went extremely wrong in my guts. A moment later, I heard the boom of a shotgun. Had I been shot? Not likely, given my situation. My vision whited out again, and my viscera caught on fire and melted. They had shot Fra Jad. The Everything Killers had been turned on. I had become a nuclear weapon, a dark sun spraying fatal radiance onto the dwellings and cultivated terraces of the Yernudan community below. We had accomplished our mission.